time since this show's music began, the spinning earth has carried the studio of KZSU some 20 miles to the east. The motion of the earth around the sun has carried us 1,500 miles westward. The drift of the solar system among the stars of the Milky Way has borne us 1,000 miles toward the star Vega. The turning pinwheel of the Milky Way galaxy has carried us 2,000 miles in a great circle around the galactic center. Verily, our universe, along with everything in it, loves to whirl. Or maybe its whirling is a manifestation of the love that moves the sun and the other stars. L'amor che muove il sole e le altre stelle, as Dante puts it in the very last verse of the Divine Comedy. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions, and our show today is devoted to the 13th century Persian poet and theosopher Jalaluddin Rumi. It's said that one day, while he was walking through town, Rumi heard the rhythmic hammering of a goldsmith. In a state of transport, he stretched out his arms and started spinning. One hand turned upward to the heavens, the other downward to the earth. He was somewhere in between the two, I would guess, borne up by the cosmic pulse he heard in that hammer, like gold to airy thinness beat. The cosmic pulse that keeps us and all other things turning and spinning. Whether around God or a monstrous black hole, who can say? I'm no mystic, nor do I aspire to be one, but anyone who spontaneously begins to whirl outside a goldsmith's workshop is always welcome on Entitled Opinions. So come on in and join us, Rumi. Nice to meet you. Have a drink, and welcome to the show. I'm joined today by Aksa Ijaz, who is pursuing her doctoral degree in classical Persian literature at the Institute of Islamic Studies at McGill University in Montreal. In a show we aired last year on the topic of separation, I read her translation of Rumi's Song of the Reed Flute and mentioned that she's a longtime devotee of Entitled Opinions. Quoting myself, if she weren't so far away, and if the studios of KZSU weren't closed down, we could get her on the show to talk about Rumi's theories of cosmic reunionism. Well, here we are about to do precisely that. The continued closure of KZSU has motivated us to find ways to do high-quality audio recordings remotely. Not KZSU quality, to be sure, but good enough to air, or so we hope. That's why Aksa can join us today from Montreal. Aksa, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Robert. It's my honor to be here.
I think it was back in 2013 when you first wrote us to thank us for the Entitled Opinions podcast. And at the time, you were still living in Pakistan. So before we turn to Rumi, would you mind sharing with our listeners how you came to discover Entitled Opinions and what drew you to the show?
Yes, certainly. My discovery of the show was purely accidental. I had bought an iPad back in 2012, and I was browsing through its various applications and its functions. And that's when I discovered your show on this little icon called iTunes University or iTunes U on my iPad. And this was very interesting because the name of your show was very interesting, very different. You know, it's Entitled Opinions about life and literature. And, well, the first show I listened to was on Hermaphroditism, if I remember correctly. But what drew me to your show, it was not the topic, but how you engaged the ideas in conversation. In Persian, this phenomenon is called sohbet, you know, where you talk to people and you share ideas with passion, and conversation is at the center of it. So this is what really drew me to your show, that, you know, you were offering the narcotics of intellectual conversation and inviting us to take part in the persecuted religion of thinking. So that's my introduction to your show.
That's great. Well, now you're on it. So we...
We're very honored.
Yes, we're going to turn our attention to this Jalaluddin Rumi, who, of course, in America is a very well-known poet. In fact, I think he might even be the most high-selling poet in the last several decades. He's an international superstar. I have to say that he's a hero for many cultures and different sects of Islam and the Christians and the Judaic religions, so forth. Unfortunately, he has been appropriated by a certain kind of feel-good, you know, New Age, kitschy type, you know, these love poems that are a little too saccharine for my taste. But there is another Rumi there that is the one that we want to get to today. And before we get into the substance of his religious beliefs, his Sufism, mysticism, his poetry, and all of the substantial things, I think that we really should start with a little bit of bio, if you don't mind. So who was Rumi, and how did he become Rumi?
Certainly, I think it's a very good idea to get into the historical figure Rumi and how we know him. Jalaluddin, Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi, or just Rumi as he's known in the West, was a 13th century Persian poet, Sufi, mystic. But more importantly, he was a jurist and a professor of Islamic law. He was most likely born in a small town called Baksh, which is now in modern-day Tajikistan. But some people claim that he was born in Balkh, which is now modern-day Afghanistan. That's why, you know, his biography is the cause of four nations disputing to be the birthplace of Rumi. He was born into a Persian-speaking family. His father, Bahauddin Balad, was a very important, very respected professor of Islamic law. And his father left his hometown, whether it was Baksh or Balkh, to escape the approaching hordes of the Mongols. At this point in the 13th century, the much of Eastern Islamic world is either being destroyed by the Mongols or is under threat. So his father preempts this threat and moves on to immigrate to westward. He goes to Anatolia, where Sultan Kekobad is in rule of the city of Konya, where he has built a very beautiful mosque. And in the center of the town, the Sultan Bahauddin Walad is going to be the professor of Islamic law there. Rumi inherits his father's seat after his father dies. And we get to see Rumi, whose fatwas and whose religious orders are asked throughout the Eastern Islamic world. He's a very important jurist at this point. In 1231, actually, he goes to Syria and Damascus, where he supposedly meets Shams for the first time. And, you know, your listeners who know anything about Rumi know that Shams would be a very important figure in Rumi's intellectual development and spiritual journey. So I guess we'll talk about him in a bit. So that's Rumi for you in a nutshell, as far as the historical portrait is concerned.
Yeah, the meeting with Shams, very important. It's where he becomes more of a mystic, more of a Sufi, as we know Sufism today. He also begins to write this exquisite poetry for the Divan poems for Shams and so forth. So then he goes on to write the Masnavi, which is the long work that we're going to also talk about.
Yes.
I'm curious, I mentioned that he is an international superstar. So I imagine, you know, in Pakistan, for example, Rumi was loomed large for the Pakistani, at least people who were interested in the literary tradition, no?
Certainly, I think those of us who grew up in the Persianate world, or the world which is now the modern nation state, but initially part of the larger Persianate world, Pakistan included in it, definitely grew with the stories of Masnavi, Rumi's magnum opus. My first introduction with Rumi was because of my maternal grandfather, who introduced me to Rumi's stories in my mother tongue, which is Urdu. Rumi's stories were very important for anybody's self-development, and usually you will inherit them from your elders who lived in your households, who would tell you stories. How a certain ethical sensibility was imparted to the young was very much through these poets, and Rumi was definitely one of the major poets used for that intergenerational transfer of wisdom and ethical understanding.
Yeah, can I ask, so there's the poetry on the one hand, and then there are stories. The Masnavi, it's both. No, it's in rhyme couplets, but there are a number of stories. Were you taught mostly the stories? Was it more the narrative or the poetic Rumi that your paternal grandfather was handing down to you?
So my maternal grandfather is handing me the stories in oral tradition, which is narrative, the content of the story rather than the rhyme. I came to know about the Masnavi as a form of Persian poetry when I was given this teaching assignment to teach a subject called Classics of World Literature in 2011 at the University in Lahore, where I also graduated from. This was the time when I discovered Rumi and his Masnavi on the page for the first time. Prior to that, my introduction to Rumi is oral because of my grandfather. And I would always associate, you know, the figure of Rumi and his wisdom with what my grandfather taught me. So for me, it was kind of a homecoming to my grandfather learning something from Rumi. Yeah, so that's the first time I discovered Rumi in English translation. And when I started teaching it, I realized how much important it is for me to learn Persian. And my own introduction and my own conversion to Persian is actually because of Rumi. Let's put it this way. I don't think it would be far-fetched to say that I learned Persian because I wanted to read Rumi in Persian.
Right. I think I want to learn Persian too, because frankly, I'm reading Rumi in English, and I haven't read all the translations, but the ones that I have looked at are, I mean, they're in an impossible bind, these translators. On the one hand,
yeah,
the Masnavi, which is a, you know, 6-volume long epic thing, but it's in rhymed couplets. So if you take away the rhymed and the couplet, then you lose the musical part of it, and you're trying to be faithful to the actual meaning. On the other hand, there's something really quite stilted and you know, very off-putting about these translations that try to reproduce the rhyme scheme. So I guess
I agree. And medieval Persian is also, you know, they rely a lot on meter. So sound and sense are not distinct. You cannot translate this. I've always found it impossible to translate Persian poetry, medieval Persian poetry, into English, for example. Because if you probably see most of the translations that try to stay loyal to the rhyme miss the meaning, and those that miss the meaning or keep the meaning lose the rhyme. So, you know, the pleasure of reading Persian poetry is in the musicality, and especially more so with Rumi, because, you know, we know the whirling dance and the whirling dervishes come from the very poetics, very aesthetics of Rumi's writing. You know, as when I read some of the verses from his Masnavi, you will see it's the movement of dance and circles and whirling that he talks about.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I have to say, I'm going to give a shout out to Dick Davies, who was on this show a few years ago. Excellent translator of the Persian. I don't know if he's ever translated Rumi. I haven't come across any translation of his of Rumi, but if there's anyone I would trust, it would be Dick Davies for that.
Certainly. Dick Davies is also a poet, so, you know, he understands the poetic sensibility of the thing too. You know, anybody who is not a poet and aims to translate poetry, I think, would be missing something.
So the Masnavi, we talked about it being a really long kind of epic work. He wrote it late in his life. He actually dictated it, from what I understand, rather than wrote it. And I made mention of the prologue to the Masnavi in my show on separation, because I read from your translation of the Song of the Reed. And, you know, we might as well begin there with hearing what it sounds like in Persian, at least in your version of Persian. And if you wouldn't mind reading the first few, you know, couplets, and I'll read the English after you.
Okay. بشنوی می چون شکایت می کند از جدایی ها حکایت می کند که از نیستان تا مرا ببریده اند در نفیرم مرد و زن نالیده اند سین خواهم شرح شرح از فراق تا بگویم شرح درد اشتیاق هر کسی که دور ماند از اصل خیش باز جوید روزگار وصل خیش من به هر جمعیتی نالان شدم جفت بدحالان و خوشحالان شدم هر کسی از زن خود شد یار من از درون من نجست اسرار من سر من از ناله من دور نیست لیک چشم و گوش را آن نور نیست تن از جان و جانستن مستور نیست لیک کس را دید جان دستور نیست آتش است این بانگ نی و نیست باد هر که این آتش ندارد نیست باد.
Yeah, I can hear the music for sure there. Here we go in your translation. Listen to the reed flute, how it complains, telling the story of eternal separations. The reed flute says, ever since they tore me from my reed bed, men and women have bemoaned my laments. I want a heart shredded with the pain of separation so that I could describe the pain of my longing for home. Anyone who is away from his home is ever longing for the day he shall return. I share my lament in every gathering, consorting with the joyous and sorrowful alike. Each interprets my notes in likeness to his own feeling, and not one fathoms the secret of my heart. My secret is not far from my lament, yet eye and ear do not possess the ability to know it. So if you don't mind my asking a question of meaning first, there's this stipulation that there was some primal unity of being, and it was followed by separation, what he calls the eternal separations. And then he speaks of these secrets. My secret is not far from my lament, the secrets of the heart. That word, as I've been reading Rumi in the last, you know, few weeks, that word secret comes forward quite a lot. So I guess I'd like to ask you if you've thought about the role that secrets play in Rumi's poetics.
The role of secret is very important in Sufi thought in general, but Rumi in particular. Secret is also kind of complemented with the Sufi idea of a veil, that between the reality, which is divine or which is the whole, and between the human cognition of it, there is an absolute veil. And in order to go through that veil, there is a certain spiritual discipline that is required. And this is the goal of a Sufi seeker, that he has to go through the travails and the internal discipline of that spiritual cleansing, the cleansing of the mirror of the heart, that becomes this way to go through the secret or to see through the secret. With Rumi, it's a very interesting thing that, you know, the entire Song of the Reed is actually suspended between what you can know and what you cannot know. But the fact that what you cannot know exists, regardless of the fact that you don't know it, does not, you know, it's a very important distinction for Rumi. So for me, it's very hard to situate Rumi as somebody who's telling you to know something that is beyond and this and that. Because if these things are not qualified into how he takes you through that system of from knowing to unknowing and knowing in particular as a whole enterprise, then I think you miss the point. Then that's when Rumi becomes that kishi, you know, love poet where he can be appropriated into a Madonna song or Coldplay song or the New Age pop spiritualism, whatever. So yeah, the secret is very much the esoteric mode of knowing the world that Rumi talks about. And this would be perhaps one of the ways to understand how Sufism works. You know, this is a mystical dimension of a religion, which is Islam. But at the same time, within Islam, Sufism does not have a place of utmost respect, right? The Sufis and the traditionalist scholars of religion would have always been in a very strange kind of tension.
Right. Exactly. So the Rumi that I like is not the Rumi who is, as you say, that it would be only a partial interpretation of him to see him only as, you know, interested in the esoteric and the unknown, what's on the other side of the veil, because it's so much what's on our side of the veil that infuses his poems, and where the phenomenological world of sound, sights, music, and so forth, I don't know if you want to call them a medium by which you pass from one world to the other, but that there's this co-presence of the secret within the manifest. I don't know if I'm putting it too doctrinally when I say that, but I think it's important for those who might want to see Rumi as only an esotericist to remember, perhaps, that he's not someone who just turned his back on this world as being inauthentic and a kind of simulation of the real thing.
Rumi was very much the person of the world. You know, he is somebody who frequents the royal courts. He's somebody who is in very close proximity with the rulers of his time. So Rumi has no pretensions of telling you that, okay, you know, the spiritual poverty, you know, the ghurbat that you need is the precondition of spiritual exercise. For Rumi, the question of reaching the esoteric, the question of reaching the beyond, actually begins in the phenomenal world. You have to feel the rhythms and the music of the world that you inhabit. So from a phenomenological perspective, you know, Rumi would be a very interesting poet to study because, you know, his whole vocabulary comes from the world of the living, from the world of the everyday, right. And more importantly, I think he's also very unique in showing you the anxieties of what can and cannot be expressed, you know, what remains central and exclusive to the mystic's heart, you know, because the kind of language that Rumi is using, the kind of language any mystic would be using, even in the Christian traditions, right? It's not the language that you and I would understand as the language of the daily speech, right? It would be the language of epiphasis, you know, the mystic would speak away. Now, the inception of Masnavi is very interesting because the tradition that tells us how Masnavi was written, it was actually at the behest of his foremost disciple, Hasanuddin Chalabi, who asks Rumi to write a book that could make Fariduddin Attar, who wrote The Conference of the Birds, Manta Kutair, and Hakim Senai, who wrote Ilahi Name and other, you know, very high esoteric literature. Hasanuddin Chalabi wanted Rumi to make both of these very difficult poets accessible to the average reader or to the average listener. How would he do that? Then he would pick up the stories, right? Rumi is drawing on his oral culture, the stories that have been told before him by these master poets. He's using the narratives that are dominant in his own milieu, the intellectual discourses that are dominant in it. So, you know, for Rumi, the world is at the heart of his work, you know. And so when we say that, okay, Rumi is a Sufi mystic who invites us to shun the world, and you just don't shun the world. I mean, the idea is very noble, right? One might as well shun the world that you have to shun anyway. But, you know, how do you do it? How do you understand it? So personally, for me, it's very important to understand that process that takes you from one point to the next.
Yeah, that brings to mind this story in the Masnavi that you first drew my attention to, the story about the competition between the Greeks and the Chinese in the art of painting and portraiture. It's very interesting. Maybe you could summarize the story and we'll relate it to what we've just been discussing.
Yes, it's one of the very famous stories from the Masnavi. It's the famous painting competition between the Greeks and the Chinese in the art of painting and portraiture. So maybe I could read the first few lines to establish what Greeks and Chinese believed and how the Sultan asked them to paint and show what their claims are. Once the Chinese said, "At art we are the best." The Greeks said, "With more talent we have been blessed." The Sultan said, "I'll set a test for you to see which of your claims is really true. They all prepared to paint a room's interior in knowledge just through the Greeks were far superior. And it goes on that both Chinese painters and the Greek painters, Rumian as they are called, so you could call them Greeks or Byzantines, they go into the room, the curtain is drawn, and that separates the two. And the Chinese are asking more paint, more equipment. You know, they want more paint, one after. There's so much commotion from the Chinese chambers. But the Greeks or the Byzantines, they don't ask for anything. There is complete silence throughout the painting competition. And when the time ends and the Sultan enters and the curtain is taken back, we see that on the one hand, you have the Chinese wall painted with beautiful imagery of birds, flowers, all kinds of phenomena, natural phenomena that is there. And when he turns back and he sees the Greek wall, it's so cleaned and it's burnished to an extent that it's now a mirror and reflects the Chinese painting, right? And that's the humor that Rumi is giving you with a very distilled understanding of the fact that the world of the phenomenon, yes, it requires effort, time, paint, and everything, right? That like the Chinese did. But it is reflected best only when the mirror of the heart is burnished, the wall of the Byzantines is burnished enough, the cleansed enough. And it's perfect as it is reflected in that art. So this is the idea that when you draw the curtain back, the world of the phenomenon, the Chinese painting, disappears, but the mirror stays. Because the mirror is going to reflect everything that is there. And the idea of the heart being not polished is actually the landmark of the Sufi thought that you have to polish the heart rather than the phenomenal world.
Right. That's the discipline of Sufism that you were talking about earlier, is how do you get there? But just to dwell a little bit on this strange relationship between the Chinese painting and the Greek cleansing to an absolute, almost empty, abstract white page, if you want, or a white slate. He says the Greeks stand for the Sufis clearly without the techniques from books or theory. They've cleansed their breasts so well that they shine bright. You could say that in a certain sense, allegoric, I don't want to allegorize it, but if the Chinese side of the room is the world, the phenomenological world that appears to us, and if the other, the Greek side, is the ultimate divine creator, then that divine is manifested in the world. No, it's reflected in the world, but it takes the cleansing of the mirror of the heart in order to see the way in which this world that appears
that is the choosing of the perception, right? He would ask, it's the expansion of the consciousness that Sufi discipline is inviting you. And the polished heart or the process of polishing your heart would be that expansion of the consciousness that would allow you to see the divine manifest in the phenomenal world, but at the same time would allow you to see how the phenomenal world is manifest.
Yeah, I don't want to overdo a line of mine, which I've used often on entitled opinions, but this is William Blake. When the doors of perception are cleansed, the world appears as it is, infinite. So exactly. The burnishing or the polishing of the mirror of the heart seems to stand for the cleansing of the doors of perception in this.
Absolutely. And Blake had, you know, undoubtedly at this time, British romantics have known Rumi's thought. And the burnishing of the heart has been very important to many of the Western thinkers.
Right. So that's great. Then you have a separation, which is not just a closing off, but it's interrelational. It's something that there's definitely traffic going through there. You mentioned Shams and the importance that this individual, this figure had in the biography as well as the religious thought of Rumi. Can you tell us something about this guy?
So Shams is a very mysterious figure in the sources. The sources describe him as a kind of itinerant mystic who is almost a madman. He's described as somebody living in the world but not off the world, very unlike Rumi, does not stand for the word of law, dismisses the idea of books and written theory and logic and everything.
He was a charismatic, in other words, no?
Very charismatic, yes. The word that is used for Shams in the sources is Qalandar, which is, you know, the whirling, itinerant mystic. He would dance, he would just talk, he has no claims on worldly manners. If he thinks that you are contradicting yourself, or if he thinks that you're too sure of yourself, he is going to call you out. So someone like you and I cannot stand in front of a person like Shams, because, you know...
Right, you speak for yourself.
...in the world of illusions. Well, he would believe that we are living in the world of illusions because we are on the crutches of language, as we have learned it by the book.
Yeah.
So...
Well, listen, in that sense, he's a Socrates also, because Socrates would very deliberately engage his interlocutor to find out, well, do you think you really know what you're saying? Let me show you that you don't know what you're saying.
No, definitely the Socratic dialectic is very much there in Shams's figure. He's asking questions, but he's not interested in winning the argument. He's interested in showing you, basically, you know, this openness of perception, the doors of perception, is very much how Shams engages Rumi. There are many accounts that tell you how Rumi first met Shams, but the one I find more believable comes from the 15th century biographer called Daulat Shah Samarkandi, who tells us in his biography of how Rumi meets Shams. And here's a little anecdote that I would like to quote. Daulat Shah tells us that Rumi was riding on a donkey when Shams suddenly jumped up and seized the reins to pose the question, "What's the purpose of self-negation and exercises of renunciation and transmission and acquisition of knowledge?" Rumi replies, "It is the path of the Sunnah and the custom of the Sharia." Sunnah being the tradition of the Prophet's life, and Sharia mean Islamic law. Shams says, "That's only the outer semblance." Rumi says, "What is beyond that?" Shams says, "Knowledge is for attaining the known." And then quotes the following couplets from Rumi's predecessor, Hakim Sanai, a poet who Rumi draws on substantially in his Masnavi. And Shams quotes, "Knowledge that takes you not beyond yourself is far worse than ignorance." Right.
Yeah.
And this is the challenge that Rumi faces from this madman who just stops him on his way and tells him that, you know, all that you think you know is an illusion. And if this knowledge does not take you away from yourself, is worse than ignorance. And Rumi develops on this motif a lot as he writes his Masnavi. And this is the shock. I would say this is the moment of conversion for Rumi, from where he becomes the scholar of Islam, the jurist of the law, you know, and becomes a lover, you know.
In fact, Shams is very much, he's very many figures. One is the figure of the lover, the one who is loved by Rumi. The other is that he does seem to be the incarnation of the divine. He speaks about Shams as sometimes, you know, as God himself. Or the presence, the manifestation. And it seems like Rumi spent a couple of years at least enthralled by and convinced that he was in the presence of the thing itself.
Yes, see, I mean, we have to remember that, you know, this is what most English translations do to Rumi's work, that they sanitize him from his Islamic worldview. Sufism is a very Islamic entity. You have to understand it. This is a very Islamic phenomenon. And Rumi would be committing a heresy if he said that he was actually in the presence of the divine. He definitely saw Shams to be the conduit to the divine, but not the thing itself. However, it's important to know that all his lyrical poems keep you suspended in that ambivalence. You know, where he, in the first ghazal, for example, the first lyrical poem of the Divan, the Persian version of the Divan, Rumi calls Shams Rastakhiz-e-Nagahan, which means the sudden resurrector.
Yeah.
So for Rumi, Shams gives him a new life, you know. It's a new life that Rumi gets. And it's not a life that he would, prescribe to people. You know, it's a life filled with blood. All that he talks about love. For example, in the Song of the Reed, there's this very beautiful couplet where he says, if you let me read the Persian original first, you can almost feel how he talks about the violence of love, what it does to you. He says, Hai kera jaame zishq chak shud, o zuhir so ayb kulli pak shud. Meaning, you know, the one whose collar is torn apart by love, only he is the one cleansed of all defect and sin.
And what does Rumi mean by love? I mean, that's something that I haven't quite understood, whether love is a drive for reunification with the primordial unity from which one was separated, whether it's that which comes between and relates different entities as well as persons. Is it human as well as divine? And is music the most sublime manifestation of that love? A lot of questions for you.
There are lots of questions, but I think they're all interconnected. Rumi's understanding of separation and how he understands love within that separation is very important. So historically speaking, Rumi is somebody who just doesn't talk about the separation at a cosmic level or of cosmic proportion out of nowhere. You know, he has historical reasons to talk about it. So first of all, his own migrations from his hometown where he escapes the Mongol onslaught and then moves to plains and mountains and all kinds of arduous journey before he reaches Konya. And then his most defining separation from Shams, because Shams's presence in his life is not accepted by his peers. You know, his family doesn't like him because Rumi spends too much time with Shams and he can't be found from months on end and so on and so forth. And then obviously that separation, when Shams has mysteriously disappeared from the scene for whatever reason, whether he was killed or whether Shams thought that it was time for him to let Rumi be on his own because he has taken him to the spiritual station where he could just have his journey by himself. Rumi definitely felt the brunt of that separation, right? And that separation, as you said, Rumi's ambivalence about Shams being the thing itself, being the presence itself, as well as the human that he associated with or he found a certain depth of emotion with, is very much at the heart of Rumi's understanding of love. Right. So it's in separation. And I think you say that in your monologue on separation, too, that it's only within separation that we love. Right. And it is within the separation that Rumi explicates his idea of love. And at the same time, love is not the antithesis of reason here, which is a common misunderstanding that is associated with Rumi. Here, the question of love in terms of Rumi, you can only understand while you understand how much importance he gives to the philosophical reasoning. And Rumi is living at a time when, Islamic philosophy is very much influenced by Hellenistic philosophy and Greek philosophy in general, right? Rumi is somebody who is also responding to someone like Avicenna, right? And he thinks that Avicenna lacks the perception of a Sufi because he is too entwined and bogged down within his methodology and philosophical proofs that he cannot see beyond the limits, right? So for Rumi, your quest through rational and empirical means, and of course this division between rational and empirical means only gets to be differentiated in the 18th century in the West, but he situates the knowledge that takes us to the limits of human consciousness and then knowledge that takes us beyond it.
In that sense, there's an affinity with Plato, I would say, as well, because Plato, especially in the Symposium with his doctrine of Eros, which is not opposed to reason, it's just that reason can take you so far, but whatever Eros understood as the intrinsic transcendence of the soul is what will finally get you across the threshold to behold the abstract, forms, the absolute forms of the other world. So I think there's a Platonism there that is very convergent with Rumi's understanding of love. But you did mention that thing. I actually got a quote, the quote from that you were referring to from that show on separation, where I say, I prefer to think of separation as primordial rather than exilic, since it makes possible relation, makes possible bonding, makes possible togetherness. And we affiliate in separation, we come together in separation, we love in separation.
Yes.
So if Rumi is present here between us, and I can see him nodding. At least I'm imagining that he's nodding to me.
I nodded on his behalf when I listened to your monologue, and I think the distinction that you were making, the primordiality of separation and exilicness, I thought, well, the world of phenomenon only exists to us because we are perceiving the world within that state of separation. Now, Rumi, you could call that primordiality God, a black hole, or whatever, you know, wherever we have come from. But there is definitely a desire to reach beyond what human reason can give us,
So can I ask, what's that? I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying that, you know, Rumi, you know, you say that it's platonic and it's...
It has a platonic strain. I don't want to say it's merely platonic. There's a platonic strain to it.
There is a platonic strain in that, but I would also say that the way Rumi makes it concrete for his reader, that journey, that intellect that you take with intellect, it's called ati, and the journey that you take with the heart, with your heart, right? That's the distinction that Sufis make, or Rumi would make in his work. He uses a very important event in the Islamic thought, which is the Prophet Muhammad's Miraj, you know, his ascension to his night journey to heavens. And he is accompanied by Angel Gabriel, who is going to take him to the heavens, where he would visit all these places. But at a certain point, he has to stop. You know, that in Arabic it's called Sidratul Muntaha, which is the farthest end of the paradise, beyond which Muhammad cannot go with Gabriel. And Gabriel here symbolizes the intellect, the reason, the spirit, the discipline that comes from human agency, right? Gabriel tells the Prophet, you know, this is the lotted tree, and you have to go beyond it by yourself, as I cannot accompany you, because if I accompany you beyond it, my wings will burn off, right? So this is a very telling image, that when intellect tries to go beyond its grasp, you know, it burns up, it is burned off, right? It just withers.
Because that is fiery, right?
Exactly. The ultimate place is fiery. So what would take you to that fire? What would allow you to bear that fire? It's love.
That's right.
And this is Rumi's understanding of love, and that is what Rumi's dream speaks of, you know? The one who lacks the fire,
right,
you know, cannot know what the reed song is.
In fact,
right? So his reed song is very, very concrete, you know, it's historically very concrete for Rumi.
Yeah, that line that you're referring to is, this plaint of the flute is fire, not mere air. Let him who lacks this fire be accounted dead. Yeah.
Exactly. So, it's one of the very famous lines in Persian poetry. Atashastin dangi nayo neist bad, harkein atash nadad neist bad.
And the next couplet is, it's the fire of love that befell the reed and made it sing. It's the ferment of love that possesses the wine. So,
yeah.
Yes, and this fire also in the Christian tradition is also the fire of purgation, of purgatory, which is a cleansing. It's kind of, it's that which burns things down to the essential, no?
Yes.
And therefore, it's also Pentecostal when you have the tongues of flame. Anyway, we could talk a lot about these interconnections, but I wanted to make sure that we say something about music, because Rumi, of course, is associated primarily with the whirling dervishes and the way in which dance and music seem to be the somatic. But it's not even somatic, because in the couplet before the one I just cited, Rumi says, body is not hidden from soul, nor soul from the body. Yet it is not the norm for someone to actually see the soul. Is it your impression that dancing, whirling, singing is the way in which the body and soul I really become one entity and, you know, perform some sort of, what would I call it, striving towards and beyond the threshold.
It's definitely, I think, a very unique level of consciousness when it is accompanied by dance and music and the whirling, right? Because what whirling does to those dervishes is to transport them into a different mode of reality. Like, their eyes are closed. The sensory organs that we have do not see or do not do their function, but it's the extended awareness, you know, that goes beyond the image or goes beyond the organs. And the couplet that you just read actually talks about that, like the ear and the heart. These are all the sensory organs, and the dervish or the mystic or the Sufi would go beyond it. And to attain that spiritual consciousness, to attain that depth of perception, music is definitely an important dimension. However, in Rumi's sense, you see, we have to remember that he is living in Anatolia at this point, and Anatolia is a very diverse and vibrant, culturally vibrant place in 13th century. People from all over the Eastern Islamic world are fleeing their homelands and coming here for refuge because this place is still in the relative peace and has escaped the Mongol onslaught, right? So Rumi is at the heart of a city which is crowded by Christians, Jews, Persians, Tajiks, Greeks, Armenians, and so on and so forth. And the hospitality is one of the factors. The cultural hospitality is one of the factors that plays a huge role in Rumi's appropriation of music. Because we have to remember that Rumi belonged to a very conservative family. His father wanted him to stay away from this pluralistic, tolerant cultural milieu, right? He did not approve of any of it. But Rumi's father was already 80 when Rumi was coming up in age, and he could not feel the influence that Rumi was imbibing in his time. So music is also very much historical, cultural reality, which Rumi then, you know, transforms into a mystical inner reality and uses it as some kind of I don't want to call it a psychedelic, but you know, it's a kind of tool for him,
sure,
that allows him to reach a different level of perception.
Speaking of Anatolia, you know, I was born in Turkey. I grew up there, and I maintain a lot of connections to Turkey. So I've been to Konya and other places and seen the dervishes a number of times, always with a sense of anguish and a sense of oppression, these dervish performances, because it seems so austere and severely inhibited. The protocols are so standard, and everything, it seems to be within very narrow limits of possibility and what's permissible. And they swirl around, and as you say, their eyes are closed and things, and you don't get, I don't get any sense of joy or real, they may have this kind of internal ecstasy, but, you know, I'll take Zorba the Greek any day, who will, dance spontaneously, on the Greek earth, and you will see that he's in connection with the land, the sea, the sky, the thing, and he, it's pure joy, which is expressing itself through his dance and the music. So I don't know whether they've taken the spirit of Rumi, you know, the ecstatic, rapturous, joyful Rumi, and put it in a straitjacket or what, but
Mevlevi order is an order, and there are hierarchies, right? There is a sheikh, and then there are these dervishes who are, you know, trying to find something. In any case, they are imitating the original, right? Here, they are imitating Rumi's joy and ecstasy that he feels for Shams. And he's very much is aesthetic with the joy of meeting Shams and even the melancholy of separation with him, right? The huzn of separation in that sense, which is a very bittersweet feeling. Melancholy doesn't really capture it, the Persian word huzn. Like everything else, you know, I think anything that is imitated lacks the spirit, but keeps the form, right? And I would find it very regimented too. To me personally, I think it's against the spirit of dance that you do while you're free, right? Rumi is somebody, I don't think that's the Rumi that you would see in these whirling dervishes as dance. That, you know, Rumi that says, There's a very beautiful couplet in Divan that says, "Mazhab-e-ishq, mazhab-e-digarast, heech kasra dar-e-u rivayat neest," meaning the religion of love is of a different kind. Anyone who follows it does not follow a tradition. So it's the absolute freedom. It's the absolute independence of human agency that he feels in love and in dance. So I share your anguish.
Well, that's great. And, you know, Access, speaking of music, now that we wind down the show, you are a musician and a singer yourself. And you, you know, music's important to you. And you've also provided us with a song in which you are the singer. And this song is related to our discussion about Rumi, although the poem that provides the lyrics for this song don't come from Rumi, but come from Hafiz or Hafez, who is also a Persian poet. We're going to leave our listeners with your song, you know, when we close the show, but maybe you can say a word about this song and who was Hafez.
So Hafez was another Persian, very important Persian poet, 14th century Persian poet, and has been very famous, still is very famous, very important to Persian culture. It is said that in Persian families, there are only two books that are staple. You know, there would be a copy of the Quran and then the copy of Hafez's Divan, right? It's used as an oracle. So this is the importance of Hafez of Shiraz, Hafez Shirazi, as he is called. This is the song that I provided you with is very famous ghazal that he wrote called Dil Mera Vajza Dastam Sahib Dilan Khodara. This song was composed originally by a very important scholar of Persian literature in Pakistan, who was also very crucial in establishing the diplomatic ties between Iran and Pakistan in the 1950s. He composed this song for a Bengali singer who sang it in a private gathering in Tehran in the 1950s. He composed it in an Indian style. So it was, for me, the song and its composition and the way it is sung epitomizes the Indo-Persian culture and how Persian culture became part of the Indian subjectivity and Indian aesthetics. His son, another very famous and very, very renowned Persian scholar in Pakistan, Surur Rushirfani, he reconstructed the melody from his memory, and he asked me to sing it, and I was very honored to sing it for the family, and this is what your listeners will be hearing in a few moments.
Well, that's great. Well, we've been speaking with Aksa Ijaz. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions. I hope you enjoyed this show about Rumi. I did, for sure, and stay tuned. We'll be back with you soon. Thank you again, Aksa.
Thank you, Robert. My pleasure.
All right.
دشمنان مدارم با دوستان مروم با دشمنان مدارم دل می رود دستم دامن معذور دامن.